We have long, you know, thought and thought about this group has, since its very beginnings, 42 years ago, has been involved in both preservation issues and copyright issues. And we're opening the meeting with two speakers who are going to address these issues separately and then in some point together, and we'll open it up to questions and have a little discussion if we have some time at the end. Our first speaker is Rob Bamberger, who, those of you who were here last year, heard Rob speak on copyright and access. Rob is a consultant to the National Recording Preservation Board to create the congressionally mandated study of the state of preservation in the United States. I worked in the Library of Congress when Congress passed this law and asked for this study, and Rob was the name that just absolutely came to everyone's mind initially. We waited a few years for Rob to become available to do it. Rob thought he could stall us off, but we couldn't. We waited for him, and I've read a lot of what Rob's done. You've heard Rob last year, and I think you know what a great choice was made by the Library of Congress in asking Rob to write the study. Rob, when he's not doing a lot of other things, is an energy analyst at the Congressional Reference Service, so understands very well writing dispassionate, nonpartisan information for Congress to help them legislate. If we think recorded sound preservation is difficult and a third rail issue, get into energy policy sometime. Particularly right now. In addition, so Rob's an energy analyst. What brings him to sound recording? Rob is the host, and now in its 28th year, of a weekly radio program, Hot Jazz Saturday Night. One of the you heard a Washingtonian begin that applause, but I remind you that this program on WAMU-FM, and I requested that be the first note you make because it is WAMU.org, is a place where you can hear Rob's program archived each week. It's a three-hour program every Saturday night, and this is usually including a two-hour presentation on a specific artist with a history, and I can't recommend it higher. WAMU is also the home of Dick Spotswood Show, which has been on almost as long. Any of our locals get away, and again on the web, but I recommend that. But I'm just going to shut up now because I really want you to have time to hear Rob and hear about the work he's doing and think about the issues that are involved in the National Recording Preservation Law. Rob?
Thank you.
For part of that, I didn't really recognize myself.
Is there a microphone around here?
I'll project more.
Don't encourage you.
I just like to mutter at the beginning. It is certainly a wonderful development that there are 80 new people joining us. I'd like to address a few comments, take a few of these minutes at the beginning to address some comments to the new people by telling you a little story of something that happened last night, because this is a great group, and I think this story will impress that upon you. It stems from one of my great anxieties. I'm afraid of name tags. Yesterday I had someone at the workshop write my name tag for me, because whenever I write a name tag, my hand begins to shake, and then I can never get it straight. It's always crooked. Now, the ones with the pins are the very worst. By the end of the conference, I usually have needle tracks. And when I get home, my wife, Chris, sort of looks at this and says, you were in the presidential suite doing drugs with Sam again, weren't you? I don't like these name tags either. Estelle was handing them out at the registration, and she handed the string and then the name, and I'm thinking, Estelle, please assemble it for me. Please assemble it for me. She didn't. She had a lot to do. So I take it back to my room, and I'm trying to thread the metal ends together, which, as all of you know, doesn't work. So I carried it to the reception. I was looking for either Karen Fishman or Nancy Seeger, extraordinary women who nonetheless still have that nurturing instinct. And I thought they would help me. Well, who do I see? The first person I see as I come through the door is George Blood. And for the 80 among you, he runs a firm called Safe Sound Archive. And George is just a terrific guy. If this is your first ARS conference, you will want to meet him, and George will be presenting later. He's also one of the brightest people in ARS. Even the stupid people will tell you that. Well, George showed me how to operate this name tag, how these metal things fan out in the back, and I realized I'd blown any chance of possibly working for George after by showing my ineptitude with this name tag. But George is such a generous guy. He did not make me feel stupid. I think what he was probably thinking is that Rob should get out more, especially to places where there are name tags. So that's a little anecdote about the kind of people who were in ARS. I also have been very anxious about being the first speaker because in vaudeville, they always put a fourth banana act on to perform while people are still taking their seats. It's wonderful that you're all in your seats. I will probably have the pleasure of seeing some of you leave your seats while I'm speaking. But I'm largely to blame for being in this position. You see, it all started when I received an email from David Giovannoni. You know, some people read a little in bed before turning out the light, but me, I take a laptop to bed and end the day leaning against the pillows, earbuds secure, connected to the internet, blissfully listening to a few cylinders from the Cylinder Preservation and Digitization Project website. Billy Murray singing, "I'm looking for a sweetheart and I think you'll do." Vess Osman's Hot Stuff Patrol, circa 1902. And Cal Stewart's Uncle Josh at the ARS Conference. Josh is surprised at how inconsistently articulate some of the speakers are, using a lot of them fancy college words and then suddenly referring to dat tape. So I'm listening to Ada Jones, 1908 Edison Gold Molded of Under the Matzah Tree, feeling quite sublime when this email from David arrives, and you know what it's like when you get an email from David, suddenly you hear, "You've got an email from David Giovannoni, Grammy winner, Berliner Email Company, Maryland." I opened it, and it was about giving this first presentation at a plenary session, any prospect of sleep. I felt like an aluminum disc that had lost its nitrate cellulose. You can relate. I immediately reported this message as spam. A week or so later, Sam phoned and left me a message that David's emails to me were being returned to him, and that David was trying to reach me about being the lead-off speaker. I hung up, blocked Sam's number, filed a report with Verizon that I was getting harassing calls. And I gave this no more thought. I thought I had snuffed this, but good. Until a few evenings later, laptop in hand, I turned down the bed covers only to find the head of my favorite plush nipper doll. Scotch 111 tied tightly around his neck and stuffed into Nipper's mouth was the cylinder recording of Silas Leachman doing "Daddy Wouldn't Buy Me a Bow Wow." I sank to my knees, the laptop clattering to the floor. My mouth was agape, words stuck in my throat. You see, I could accept that Nipper could be strangled with Scotch DynaRange 290, something with a mylar or tensilized polyester backing, but acetate? I know Scotch 111 when I see it. And that's when I knew I had to be dreaming. The next morning, I phoned David and I said, "I have got to tell you about this dream I had last night. It's really a scream." And so I told him all about it. Big mistake. My bad. Because here I am. Well, as Sam alluded, the study that I've been carving my way slowly to produce is required by the Recorded Sound Preservation Act of 2000. And rather than get immediately immersed into the details of some of what the study will report, I'd like to take a few moments to pull the camera back to outline a larger perspective in which the study's been percolating. In many respects, the major feature of the Recorded Sound Preservation Act was modeled after the Film Preservation Act of 1988 and its subsequent extension in 1992. Let me note, however, that that 1988 Act, which is very, very short, it established the film registry and a panel to make nominations for films to be included in the registry. That 1988 Act was buried in an Interior Appropriations Act for fiscal year 1989. The extension was included in the Copyright Amendments Act of 1992, and it wasn't until this stage that a board was formally established and a study on the state of film preservation was required. And that study was directed to take into account the objectives of the National Film Preservation Program, to be written in consultation with parties involved in film preservation, and to examine the concerns of private organizations and individuals, I'm quoting now from the law, private organizations and individuals involved in the collection and use of abandoned films outside the entertainment field. Well, that study was written in 1993, and a national plan, which was also required, appeared the next year, 1994. And indeed, there was a meeting in Los Angeles just a few years ago in 2006, bringing together members of the film board to discuss updating the national plan because the landscape had changed. Now, it merits noting that in the wake of the film law, a number of programs in film preservation were launched at universities. And additionally, as authorized by the law, a National Film Preservation Foundation was established. You may know it's issued some rather nifty box sets of preserved films of many sorts. There's a William S. Hart movie in the first collection titled Hell's Hinges that's really not to be missed. I've gone into some detail about the film preservation law, not to be a renegade, but for a reason, because I want to show in these next few minutes that while the particulars of the film and recorded sound laws parallel each other in many, many respects, the worlds of film preservation and recorded sound preservation at the time these laws were enacted were hugely different. There has been some convergence, I will allow, since, but there remain some fundamental differences. Like the film law, the Recorded Sound Act established a registry where initially 50 recordings were designated, isn't that right, Sam? And now it's been peeled back to 25. Recordings to be added to the registry on an annual basis, and there is a commitment, a requirement to preserve these recordings in the best possible way. And the sound called for a study, a national plan, and also authorizes the establishment of a Recorded Sound Foundation. We might wonder why a dozen years passed before a recorded sound preservation bill was enacted. In part, the film preservation law came about as a response to the threat of colorization of black and white movies. Some in Hollywood actually sought for Congress to outlaw colorization as a national policy. Well, the Film Preservation Act stopped well short of that, but it was at least a national response of some magnitude to the hue and cry over colorization, and any kind of response at the congressional level is no small thing. I can tell you, for all the bills that are introduced in two sessions, very few become public law. Of course, some of you might say that's a blessing. Had the colorization issue come up 10 years earlier, I have thought there might have been a comparable cause celebre for recorded sound, which I can express in five words: electronically rechanneled to simulate stereo. But by this time, the separate pressing of mono and stereo records had essentially ended, and the general public didn't grasp that simulated stereo was truly a problem of national proportions. Nor did the public grab up their clubs and take to the ramparts when the album covers of many a Columbia reissue of 78 RPM era recordings bore this banner, digitally remastered from the original analog tapes. Of course, there was far more than just a grain of truth to that, because Columbia was digitizing taped transfers of 78 RPM era recordings that they had made in the 1960s and 70s. They were, by and large, not going back to the vaults and the metal parts. At this time, there was, and he still is, a literary critic for the Washington Post, a very smart man, who was declaring in his column that these digitized reissues from the original analog tapes made the music sound better than it ever had originally, thus proving, when it came to understanding the true meaning of digitization, someone who was culturally literate could be as dumb as a bag of rocks. It may be, I think, that digitization, which should have created a sense of urgency, instead may have had a numbing effect on the public at large. Well, when embarking on the recorded sound preservation study, there were expectations. I mean, Sam says, my name kept coming up. I did not know at the time so many people disliked me. There were expectations here and there that the film preservation study could serve as a model for the recorded sound study. But it was apparent very quickly how different addressing recorded sound in the last half of the first decade of the 21st century would prove from examining film preservation in the mid-1990s, because the passing of just 10 years presented such a different universe, for recorded sound, changes that have also profoundly altered the woof and warp of the daily work of the greater number of you. So you know all about that from your firsthand experience. So let's now take a little bit of a look at how this altered landscape plays out between film and recorded sound, especially as the writing of the study enters into its blessedly final months. To begin with, film is film. It may be silent, it may be sound, it may be 8mm, 16mm, 35mm or more, it might be nitride, it might not be, but it's still film. And with no intention on my part of being dismissive of the skill that's brought to film preservation, nonetheless, it's a process with parameters, I think, that can be easily, or reasonably easily understood. Film is pretty much film, but what is recorded sound? It's cylinders, it's 78s, it's lacquers, it's metal parts, it's little wonders, maybe it's big wonders. 7, 10, 12, and 16-inch discs, it's field recordings made on wire and open reel tape and cassettes. It's dictaphone, it's VCR cartridges, it's PCM, it's DAT tape, it's mini discs, it's CDRs, it's analog, it's digital, it's murder. Let me pause for a moment and be very fashionable and do something interactive here. I know there are many individual sound recording collectors here. And let me ask, setting aside audio that you've done of your family and your pets, how many of you hold in your collection something that you believe to be a recording of some, a unique recording of historical or cultural significance that would be of interest to others and should absolutely survive you? I thought so. I wish we had time. I'd love to find out what they all are. I have one or two items too. Well, my surmise is, and I think we've proved it, that there are a far greater number of important and unique recordings in private hands than we would find unique film footage in private collections. We know how many and what films we've already lost, and save for the occasional and welcome discovery, we know pretty much what we still have, and we also know where the major film collections are held. In sharp contrast, we haven't a clue how much recorded sound we have, and we've not the slightest idea where most of it is. We've no idea what we've already lost, or what's in imminent danger of becoming irretrievable. Expressed another way, as I say, we haven't a clue. Saving grace here is that we all know that we haven't a clue, making it really a state of awareness, not ignorance. We know what we don't know, and it certainly makes all of us quite uneasy. And when the momentum began to build for film preservation, there was little expectation of access. You generally found people to be supportive of film preservation for its own sake. During the 1980s, if you contributed $100 to the AFI or some other institution to support restoration of a print discovered of a significant film that was lost or one that needed rescue, would you have considered that your entitlement that the film once restored, that you be given a copy or have access to a copy? And would the question of access at that time have even influenced your decision in any way to support preservation of that film? Would you feel differently today about supporting a film or recorded sound preservation initiative if access to these important images and records, sounds, would be shelved and out of reach owing to copyright or other obstacles? Well, these are some of the ways that I wanted to sort of walk through that the canvas that we all collectively face has become so huge, and to my disadvantage, it was reflected in the scope of the study of recorded sound preservation called for by the 2000 law. Let me summarize that briefly. I mentioned the parameters of the film study a few moments ago. The law stipulates five, or really six, elements. Among them, the current state of sound recording archiving, preservation, and restoration activities, something that I can write up during lunch. The methodology and standards needed to make the transition from analog open reel preservation of sound recordings to digital preservation of sound recordings. Standards for access to preserve sound recordings by researchers, educators, and other interested parties. The establishment of clear standards for copying old sound recordings, including equipment specifications and equalization guidelines. Current laws and restrictions regarding the use of archives of sound, I've spoiled mine. Regarding the use of archives of sound recordings, including recommendations for changes in such laws and restrictions to enable the Library of Congress, see there's someone leaving, to enable the Library of Congress and other nonprofit institutions in the field of sound recording preservation to make their collections available to researchers in a digital format. Breathless, copyright and other laws applicable to the preservation of sound recordings. A different world indeed. And we have a measurement of that just by the fact that we're the Association for Recorded Sound Collections, and yet our opening session includes a major address on copyright, and copyright is very much the focus of this session. Copyright certainly is an issue for film, but when the Film Act was passed, it was not really a disincentive to preservation, except in some isolated instances where there might be some sort of hold on the underlying literary work, which was, I know, for example, a problem for years back in the 70s and early 80s with animal crackers. But by the time Congress turned to recorded sound preservation, issues of access were becoming joined, indeed so closely intertwined that it's become, as Sam alluded, one of the major initiatives of ours to propose and push for solutions for which we may be grateful for the visionary leadership of Tim Brooks and some very able lieutenants. Well, this has been a long-winded preamble, I concede, to talking a bit about the study, but I hope you see it's had purpose. Our collective noses are so close, I think, to the grindstone that it's easy to lose sight of that larger world in which we have to make our case for preservation and to raise awareness outside our community, especially with respect to the public consciousness of the scope of the recordings we're seeking to serve. What the study will say is really well known and old hat to you. In many ways, there's just not going to be any surprises here. And it was so apparent in the workshop yesterday, and also just from attending successive ARS conferences, that the discussion is deepening enormously with every passing year. This is reflected in the presentations that make up the conference program. So I do want to go through a few of the tenets of the study. Again, it may sound a little surface to you, but bear in mind the audience for the study. My reasons for sharing some of it with you is really to get some feedback from you during the next few days, if the right emphasis is being struck and conveyed to that intended audience, which is primarily Congress and other policymakers, but also educators and potential funders and other communities that are empowered to promote the preservation of recorded sound. And you may know that in support of the study, we held a couple of public hearings in New York and Los Angeles, at which some of you made very valuable contributions. We had there were workshops on conversion from analog and treatment of digital sound. There have been some reports by June Besick on copyright issues, post-72 recordings and pre. And there was a convening of a meeting in Austin, Texas to talk about sort of a prototypical development of an educational curriculum. Now, the study has really four principal parts, looking at collections, technology, education, and copyright. And I'll bullet a few things from each. Clearly there's overlap, but we'll see what sort of trail we can follow. Are you in charge of my elapsed time? Let me know when I'm 10 minutes over. It'll begin, of course, with the question of why preserve? And so in that respect, I'd like to share with you a quotation from T-Bone Burnett, who testified in Los Angeles, and the Grammy folks secured him for us. He spoke to many things, but in this quotation I want to share with you, he's speaking as a recording artist of several years. This is actually a condensation of two of his remarks. The first was so fascinating that I did what any good therapist would do. I looked squarely at Mr. Burnett and remarked in a very soothing tone, "Say more." And he remarked, "Somebody will call me and say, I've got some tapes of yours that you did at Sound City in 1965 and some boxes. Do you want them?" And T-Bone says, "I paid no attention to that. That's the time when I was a kid. That stuff was left all over everywhere. Now it's beginning to be a lot more meaningful to me, and I'm so grateful to get these things back. And the first thing we are doing is transferring them to digital. When we were working on these things in the 1960s, the idea was to get it on the radio, make some money, and move on. But at this point, you begin to realize that the things you do in your life actually have meaning and are important. You know, one of the arguments for preservation, of course, that always gets trotted out is that we need to preserve because of the historical and cultural significance of sound recordings. But what T-Bone's comment lays bare, and it's a point I very much want to make in the study, is that often significance gets conferred on recordings long after they were made. It's like the quotation attributed to one of the swing era vocalists who remarked that if she'd known what interests there someday would be in the big bands, she'd have slept less on the bus. So it furthers the objectives of sound preservation if there's some vision or understanding that we shouldn't always wait until the significance of a sound recording is apparent and then protect it. We may have lost very valuable time. And this is one reason why the interests of recorded sound preservation are served, will be served by people with a certain measure of cultural legacy and knowledge of history. A leading thread of the study in the executive summary will be to note that the preservation of analog and digital sound recordings presents some very different as well as similar challenges. I imagine that most general readers of the study will be coming to the table with a cheerful outlook that digital technology has only delivered blessings upon us, that it's an end point. And I imagine that most of you who are librarians and curators, as one label archivist told me, would much rather see someone troop in with stacks of reels of magnetic recording tape than a hard drive. The reason being, because preservation of sound recordings is no longer a set of discrete actions, so much as it will need to be a process, you well know this. There are many outside this organization, I'm very convinced, who've yet to take this in. They haven't a clue either. And others lack the resources to put such a process in place, and it seems clear that one of the things, one of the needs that may surface in the national plan is the need to create a conduit or the means for pooling of information and experience, as well as the sharing of metadata and preservation copies. We have a big problem in that born digital is resulting in a burgeoning accumulation of recordings with every passing moment. During the course of the time that I'm speaking, I just wonder how many sound recordings are being created that we'll want to save. The penetration of computers into our society and digital technology has, and this is the word that comes to me, democratized the ability to make sound recordings like never before, at a scale many multiples of the facilitation of the past. And I mean, it all starts, I think, with the introduction of the cassette and its portability. And while we have a great concern about the stability of older analog recordings that need some attention, we are looking at an accumulation without end of born digital that's going to be threatened by the rapid obsolescence of the software and the technology that created them and allows them to be reproduced, and the physical hardware that stores them. Legacy format recordings are being lost owing to a lack of resources of many kind, not just financial, but also a diminishing cadre of people familiar with those formats and the ability to maintain the equipment, to fix it, to find the hardware to do it. I look at some of you out here and I see dinosaurs. You're smart dinosaurs, because they supposedly had a brain the size of a pea. You're smart dinosaurs, but you're still dinosaurs. We found there are not enough programs at the graduate level to prepare librarians and archivists for recorded sound preservation and, most importantly, or as important, archive management. We've made a start, but there's much to be done to provide the training and skills that are going to be needed. And there will need to be lots of science, and it will be important that candidates that enter some of these programs will have a solid grounding in the humanities and history. We're going to have to be Renaissance people. And this educational grounding is critical because it does relate to the technical challenges that are presented. Preserving sound, requiring monitoring developments in software and equipment. But as we've already alluded, it also requires some sort of vision. I have great empathy for you because many of the archivists and institutions with which I gained some familiarity, you know that some kind of long-term vision is going to be essential, but you have no room in your day, in your energies, to visualize that future because your present is so swamped with challenges and resource issues. Many small archives, particularly uncertain how to proceed, how can you do preservation of the scale and quality that's been discussed at these conferences? One of the larger questions being, how can small archives be helped? The reflexive answer is to say, let the big institutions help. But there is one of the sad rubs, because we found that even the larger institutions are starved for resources. As one person said, more money, more people, more time. So the question will be posed, and maybe the plan will be addressing how the small and large archives can complement each other's efforts. The study will also make clear that one of the major questions is, what are the best preservation practices at a given time? How does this information get out into the community? And one of the major discussions and debates that I would actually love to hear more about from you and actually in ours is whether there is any acceptable balance that can be struck between the quest for perfection and digitization efficiencies, such as multiple signal transfers, intermittent monitoring, technologies that may make some compromises. What compromises in preservation are preferable to losing sound altogether? I think that's a core and very troubling question, because these dinosaurs are perfectionists, and bless you for it, and I think many of the others among us are too. And then you have the metadata problem, dozens and dozens of information fields. How is it to be created, managed, shared? And that bridges us into the next little theme, collections. Many different sorts of collections out there. Not just those held by institutions, but ones that are specialized, such as collections of radio recordings, ethnographic recordings, artist or category specific collections, public and private, even quasi-public and quasi-private. One individual put it very well at one of the hearings, remarking, and I will quote again, "It's difficult to mobilize resources to preserve something that you do not even know you have." And here we're talking about collections within the wall of institutions and not the uncertainty of what's out there. It was really interesting at yesterday's workshop to hear about the number of planning grants that are now out there. Just to help you get started, Kristen Murphy talked about that and had a list of questions to determine whether you're really looking for a planning grant. Questions like, have the materials been identified, been prioritized, been inventoried, been cataloged, been stabilized? And these are some of the things that I know future presentations at this conference will be addressing. It struck me yesterday, thinking of the planning grant as a preamble, and then the core work of preservation, but then there's the digital repositories, which will be almost sort of a postamble. So, as we've said, stewardship of collections is going to require so much more than knowledge of how to make or perform oversight over the transfer and preservation of recordings. We've mentioned the grounding and the ability to anticipate the social and historical value of certain collections. and that this needs to be balanced against the condition of the recordings. Fate has not decreed that it's only the collections of lesser interests that are in the worst shape. Balancing between the degree of threat to a collection and the measure of its cultural historical value, what sort of guidelines can assist you in that difficult decision of striking that balance? If any one of us had that solution, we would be revered. We would be at your feet. And that brings us to the point at which preservation and access becomes joined at the hip, where there's the expectation of access. As was said often yesterday at the workshop, it was once anticipated that access meant travel. But as we know, institutions don't necessarily hold the rights to the sound recordings in their collections, and distribution over the internet is a problem. And what we learn from that is that it will grow even more difficult to attract the resources to save important recordings if access is impermissible. And this will be one of the things that I hope to communicate in the study. And that leads us to copyright, which I won't belabor because I talked about that last year. And incidentally, this being described as a preview of the study, there will be no preview part two next year. I will be in rehab first. Or the consultant protection program. Or both. Let me just summarize copyright. David Soibert, I want to flatter him by quoting him from the Los Angeles hearing. David said, with limited funds, a greater impact can be made today by funding the preservation of materials that can be put online versus materials that would have to be listened to in the reading room of an archive or copied only after securing permission from the copyright holder, if that individual is even known. Increasingly, materials that are not online are going to be used less than other materials, and use is largely the determining factor in what gets preserved. There was an interesting comment made yesterday. I think Rachel said this. It was one of the slides on the screen suggested that it's not just access, but it's access plus use, making people aware of what's out there. I thought that was an interesting point. Well, good heavens. Well, a critic. What's that like there?
All right, sir. You're just going to serve.
This also goes to show you that being president of ARSC has a glass ceiling.
Yeah. Sorry, I'm fine.
But it's very hot.
Oh, I'm sure it is, yeah.
Congress has yet to appreciate how copyrights become the flypaper of access. Ask any member of Congress, are you for preservation? The answer is yet, you bet. But some do think that tying preservation's interest to copyright law is a ruse to get at copyright law. That law is staggeringly complex. Even the sincerity to understand and respect it doesn't make it penetrable. U.S. copyright law governing sound recordings thwarts access for education, research, other legitimate purposes. I'm hurrying now because and in so doing, copyright law may be blunting progress in preserving sound recordings of incalculable value. And this is in part because it's really difficult for copyright law to keep pace with developments in digital technology. It's also because copyright does have a legitimate purpose in protecting intellectual property, and it's proven difficult to fashion law that will operate selectively in certain circumstances. So much is at stake. There's a medical condition where it's discovered that the nerves of the brain are all sort of tangled and bundled. It's quite serious. One thought that the study may have will underscore a need to untangle access and preservation issues so that intellectual property law can perhaps further preservation while protecting the legitimate interests of intellectual property. I don't think there's an aggregate solution. I think it's got to be unbundled, and Brandy Carl may suggest that I'm proving how little I know of law. Now, being the first speaker, I do want to, for the sake of speakers who follow, give you a little piece of advice. This is the moment when one might be inclined to say, and in closing. And I don't do that because I've learned from experience that the moment I do that, it's like I'm in a stadium and there's a great wave of people. So let me make a few penultimate remarks about my opening remarks. And I hope that confused everyone. Well, much good came out of the activities pursuant to the Film Preservation Act, the development of film preservation curricula, the establishment of labs devoted to film preservation, and a very vibrant Film Preservation Foundation. But as I said earlier, I do think the challenge at the time that was prepared was much, much simpler. There were and still are a limited numbers of formats in film with which to wrestle, and the film community has made itself a little bit insular. They've successfully kept video out of their domain, a really fragile medium that would likely divert attention and resources. But I don't think we can wall ourselves off. Just in this room, there are many more and disparate communities, and we know that recorded sound preservation and its interests can't be compartmentalized. But when we talk about preserving sound, it's apparent that, you know, people outside these sorts of groups don't have a grasp of the breadth of the universe that we're trying to save. Typical was the encounter I had one day with a lab technician who was doing a blood draw, which is a condition of my parole. And I mentioned this work I'd been doing, and he thought it was all about preserving music. So what a challenge I think we have to raise awareness of what recorded sound truly, truly encompasses. It seems, I think, so basic to us that we lose sight, perhaps, that the message really hasn't taken root out there. And I do hope the study will plant it, will plant the idea that the panorama is really enormous. I caution my Library of Congress colleagues with respect to their confidence in my qualifications that yours is a sandbox I've only played in by virtue of being a record collector and producing a radio show. I've not lived in your sandbox. I've paid some longer visits to it now, long enough to see the great sense of mission and purpose that drives so many of you in what you do, no matter which community of ARSC is claiming your time and your focus. A glance at the conference program, as I've suggested, reflects the new and ongoing initiatives to tackle some of the problems I've bulleted. And many presentations this year build on ones from conferences past, like FACET, which we heard about, is now available to us all. And some of this scholarship is practical, and some of the presentations are driven by the sheer pleasure of satisfying your own and the curiosity of many of us about the past, present, and future of recorded sound. And I've been frankly worried that the study now in the final phase of drafting is not going to do you the justice that I feel you so much deserve, the credit that you merit. I think all of you are the best cat herders in the world. And I hope after the study's published, more of the world will see it. When we try to make the case for doing recorded sound preservation properly, it seems that we have to begin at that level of preamble I cited before by answering the question for people, that question, why preserve? Perhaps with completion of the study and the subsequent national plan, we may see the stirring of a shift where the dialogue begins not with the inquiry, why preserve, but with the response, how can we not? You can look at your watches now. And I thank you for your very kind attention.
Very much. I don't know about us working in a sandbox, unless it means you sort of have sand in your underclothing, it might be it. But I think that colleagues of mine, the Library of Congress and other places, believe strongly that you're at the crux of what preservation is, which is tracking down rare recordings, thinking about them, contextualizing them, and then ultimately sharing them in what you do in your program. So you very much are a part of our world, whether you want to be or not. This thing about tracking down the program, I mean, I wanted, my leitmotif in the about 9 or 10 times I'm going to be up here this weekend is about our commitment to access, which many of you have heard about. One is that all of the program of this weekend is, of course, being recorded as it is, and it will be streamed on the internet and available to the public for free. So when you go home and you'd like to enjoy and think about Rob's talk again, you go to arscaudio.org, and you and everyone else can hear these again. And by the way, for those who are listening, that was not a pot shot taking it, Rob, or myself. A light bulb burst here.